Hello, welcome to Bipolar Number 7, Episode 3. Before I make a start, I'll just have a quick story about quite an amusing conversation I had with my mother over the last week. And it's when you have severe road rage. Now, I'm not really an angry driver, but when I do see red, and obviously the initial reaction is to park your horn. I've hardly done it in my time. I've had my current car, which is about 6 years. And the other day, I had this car coming towards me, overtaking another car. So it was coming completely face on towards me. And obviously, I saw my life pass me by. It was quite a scare. So all I had was the opportunity to press this horn to show my severe anger, and I pressed it, and it was like the equivalent of bloody Mr. Bean wagging his finger at you. It was absolutely pathetic, and I told my mum this story, and she toppled it by saying, when she once got into a bit of road rage, she couldn't figure out where her horn was. So next thing she know, she's accidentally pressed the windscreen wipers. So I thought I'd share that with you because it did make me laugh. Anyway, back to the serious stuff. Today's episode is about the 5 ways I got my shit together following my diagnosis in 2010. So all will be revealed of the 5 ways I got my shit together. This is episode 3 of Bipolar Number 7. Okay, the first way I got my shit together happened 3 years ago when I was sat in the cafe at the marina and there was a girl next to me and I started chatting to her about what she did for a living. She was a dog walker. I says I've always wanted a dog, but like most things, you know, you work full time, you kind of look at all the reasons why you can't have one and you never end up getting one. Anyway, she said that the chef was looking for someone to take his because it was his son's and his son had just split up from his girlfriend. Anyway, 24 hours later, I've had it passed to me for me to meet him. I'll never forget the look on his face when he jumped out of his car. He could hardly see because he hadn't been groomed for God knows how long. He was in a right state. So he hopped onto my boat and he was crawling all over the place, sniffing around. And about an hour later, because I do like an afternoon nap, I've had an afternoon nap. I wake up and he's lying next to me. And from that moment onwards, we've kind of stuck by each other through the good times and the bad. We've had holidays together, have booked us expensive hotels. We stayed, went to Bamborough Castle, stayed in a very posh hotel there. I'll never forget going up to the reception, seeing the receptionist and thinking, oh God, this is embarrassing. And then she just checks us in. Oh, Mr. Baldwin and Alfie the dog. And at that point, I was like, "This is not exactly how I planned my life." But it's been fun. He's very much a boy's boy. He loves his ball. He loves his food. He loves his drink, because I always kid myself that he's got this kind of, because he's from Scotland, the Isle of Skye, he's got this thick Scottish accent. Comes across as a bit of a Ramsay Nesbitt / Billy Connolly, and drinks Tennent's and swears like a trooper. So I always have a bit of a joke that if I've not walked him enough and he kind of pulls to one side, he's basically telling me to up and get my shit together and start walking me. So yeah, the first thing I had to mention, because he has been a game changer. Complete unconditional love is Alfie, my dog. Okay, the second way I got my shit together, and probably out the five, the most important one, is network. Obviously, the support through any kind of illness or health concern is going to be essentially as important than anything. You know, I mentioned on my first episode, Desert Island Discs, towards the end about being loved, and you know, that heals so many wounds. And I've been very fortunate, even before I was diagnosed with bipolar, to have that. But yeah, going to the start, and before I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, I always had a good doctor. Moving from Yorkshire to Leicestershire in 1990, that's when I first came across them. Can't remember seeing him much in the formative years of my life, but certainly when I was diagnosed, so that would have been 2010, I went on a bit of a lost weekend in Jersey. Now, there's an image on all my social media platforms of me just lying on, it's like a little jetty that overlooks the ocean. And that was it was a poignant picture that was taken. And it was a weekend which kind of I lost my way, to a point where I was trying to get into one of these psychiatric homes. But thankfully, between my mum and the doctor, you know, that kind of saved me from going in. So from that point onwards, I've always had a very close relationship with him and the doctor's surgery. I've been very fortunate in that respect. They've always helped me, understood me. I felt like it's been a doctor's where I know that they're under a lot of pressure, but you know, they've always cared for me, which you hear a lot of horror stories. So having a doctor that understands, and a surgery that, you know, provides the services that it does, has really helped me. And then obviously with family, that's been paramount along the way. I've got a very close relationship with every member of my family. I've got some really good close friends. I've got a chap, Matt, who's going to be actually featured next week, so you're going to hear his delicate tones. I've confided in him a lot recently, and he's been very helpful and supportive. So it's, you know, it's been very important to actually reach out, not to the masses, but I'll go on to that on another episode, when I actually did, you know, speak to a lot of my friends, and I had mixed reactions, some of which, you know, didn't understand it and weren't educated it as well as others, and you know, as I was when I first heard of bipolar disorder. So number two, and like I say, probably the most important area of my recovery, has been support network. Okay, number three is balance. And what I mean by balance is getting my work and life balance, to ensure that it's suitable for my condition. There were two examples I could remember. In 2008, I was working in a job I didn't enjoy, an industry I didn't enjoy, office environment I didn't enjoy, colleagues who I didn't get on with. The whole thing had a detrimental effect on my mental health. So that was pre-diagnosis. And then it came to 2016, which I was in a happy place, but again, I burnt myself out. You know, I had my own corporate personal training business. I was living in my flat in Manchester. I had some good friends. But unfortunately, I got made redundant, and therefore I was working 6 days a week, feeling the strain of obviously self-employment. And with a condition such as bipolar disorder, it can creep up on you, you know, unexpectedly. So from then, I made a bit of a brave decision in 2016 to move back to my mum's, sell my flat, and of all things, buy a narrowboat. Now, at the time, when I told my dad, I'll never forget his response was, I'm going to go and get a glass of whiskey, which I found quite amusing. I've not looked back since. Never, ever regretted it. Suits me down to a T. I'm starting to build a bit of a community online as well as offline, of fellow boaters who've got, you know, really good ideas in terms of decorating and maintenance, and just having this kind of free spirit mindset of, you know, getting away from the rat race and just enjoying nature and what's out there, the great outdoors, especially of late, you know, with the lockdowns and people struggling. I think, you know, it's there to be had, really, there to be seized upon. So that, to me, in 2017, when I bought the boat, was, again, I talk about a life-changing decision. That was the big decision that I made that ensured that the balance between working and living went hand in hand. Didn't have to earn as much, so initially I took on a responsible job, really. It was a manager's job of a big sports facility, and like most jobs, I gave it my all. Didn't realise, but the commute ended up taking its toll. I then got my dog, so obviously with that, you know, it's a big responsibility. So I was spinning quite a lot of plates, and as my mind works, I was taking on other projects at the same time. You know, I couldn't kind of relax. That ended because of my health. And then I just dipped in and out of jobs, that kind of suits me, from being an extra on the new Batman film to mystery shopping to working for a family business to, you know, I've done all sorts. I'm generally very happy with that. You know, I'm not one for commitment. I'm not one for having a career. Certainly not one for being micromanaged or managed at all. I've got quite a, you know, I don't know what the word is, but I don't like being told what to do. I think that stems from childhood, being at school. So number three is balance. I'd say number four is giving up the booze, but just for 10 months. Now these five I just quickly jotted down, so they might actually not be definitive, but I've thrown this in because it kind of made me think about alcohol. And my therapist once said to me, because I kept saying to her, you know, a lot of these problems I have tend to appear when I've gone through a stage of drinking too much, and I've never been a huge drinker. I've as time goes on, like a lot of my close friends and brother and, you know, other family members, become not connoisseurs but enjoy the finer drinks, you know, whether it's red wine or guest ales. And I've kind of gone through to that phase. So there'd be no way I'd be getting home from a day at work and drinking 7 or 8 pints of guest ale and a bottle of red wine. I've never gone down that route. Because of the marina life, and when it's sunny, there is sometimes a a danger in terms of, you know, because it's such a sometimes tranquil setting and you're kind of happy, and those kind of moments can creep up on me. But because of lockdown, and I'm very grateful for lockdown, last September, and it was on the back of going through a period where I think there was a lot of, looking back on it in hindsight, there was probably a lot of stress that I didn't realise. Work-wise, you know, I was furloughed, financial, didn't know, a bit lost again, which happens, you know. And then September came, and I'd suddenly realised that I was drinking a bit too much. And then that moment on, I went 10 months without having a drink. And if I'm completely honest, and this, I don't want this to come across arrogantly, because there's nothing I read. I wasn't exercising. I didn't go on a big health kick or regime. I just cut out alcohol. One thing I did realise, though, is I was mildly depressed during those 10 months, which isn't a great advert for giving up alcohol. It's just the way I was. I don't know whether the two run hand in hand, when, because I know in the past, when I have been down, having a drink doesn't appeal to me. But the thing I'm taking out of it is the fact that I don't rely on alcohol to, I don't know, get through in life. You know, I've never been into drugs. I think with alcohol now, I've come to realise that I don't want to give it up. You know, it's one of those things that as long as I'm taking my medication, as long as I'm eating reasonably well and I'm exercising and, you know, I'm engaging in social activity and support, I think having a drink now and again is never going to harm me. I think, you know, stripping that out of me would really damage my kind of creative part of my brain. And, you know, there's a lot of things I like. You know, when I make a Sunday dinner, I like a glass of red wine, and those moments are kind of cherished. So for me, again, for my condition, having 10 months without any alcohol was brilliant. Coming out of it, I've, you know, since had a drink now and again. Again, moderation has been key, and that's what the doctors have always said. You hear some stories about, you know, giving it up full stop. I think sometimes that can be a bit dangerous in terms of, you know, people have the tendency to completely get back on it. Everyone's different, whether you're medicated, non-medicated, whether you've got bipolar, whether you've got any condition, everyone's brain's different and we all react differently and we're all into different drinks, different percentages, we act differently. So it's a complete and utter jungle out there in terms of alcohol. So, but it definitely has helped me, and it's more mentally in terms of I've got that willpower than anything. So number four has been giving up alcohol for 10 months. Okay, number five is minimalism. What I mean by that is, over the last 10 years, life has got a lot quicker, from being online and seeing all this stuff and information passed in front of your eyes when you open, I don't know, a social media page, to seeing the news 24/7. You know, everyone wants to be liked, everyone wants to be wearing the latest things. You know, it's become to me something that I've become to despise, but that's my own personal choice. Now, when I say minimalism, that caters for absolutely everything from materials to watching too much football on telly to even worrying. You know, worrying less has become my latest thing. You know, if you can't do something about what's on your mind, then put it away. You know, to friendships, you know, there's again, I'm doing an episode of you know, when I told people about my condition, you kind of start realizing who are really, you know, there for the long game in terms of being your friend, and which friends you kind of just want to put away and kind of think, well, it was nice knowing you, you know. So what I've tried to create in my life, and it's ongoing, you know, I've just picked up this book again, which I read about 10 years ago, about these two chaps that worked in New York City and gave up their jobs, you know, had a garage full of junk and stuff that they didn't want, gave up the jobs that they'd worked for, you know, 10, 20 years, because it was affecting their relationships and they weren't happy, and they woke up and completely changed. You know, they weren't into this whole consumerism way that most people tend to be. So for me, it's been very, very important just to have this kind of clearer headspace. I'm still not there. You know, it's just little things like clearing my emails every day, you know, making sure my desktop or my computer is nice and clear. I don't have a picture on my desktop because, you know, there's hundreds of pictures that I need to still sort out. It's just little things. You could go on and on, you know, making sure my journals are nice and clean and tidy and they've got a date on the top, and, you know, I'm not scratching around for a journal because I seem to have about 12 and none of them are complete. You know, I'm a narrowboat now because I'm starting to list it on an Airbnb, as an Airbnb. So that's really helped. I've got rid of a lot of things. But then I've also put things into storage where I think, well, if I don't touch that in 6 months, I'm just going to get rid of it. And that's you know, DVDs, records, clothes, things that you're a little bit unsure of. But one of the things that I've done in the last 3 months, which I was speaking to my brother actually, it's as simple as sorting out your sock drawer. How good does it feel to get rid of some of your socks? And you look at them and you think, Christ. And these aren't even socks that I've got holes in. These are just socks that you kind of think, well, I don't feel comfortable in them when I put them on, and I can't remember where I bought them, or, you know, you don't like the colour. You know, it's just simple things. And then you say to yourself, well, there's 7 days in a week, so I need 7 socks because I do a wash every week. So, and I personally don't like wearing socks, but that's a different story. So just clearing out your socks, and then you've got a spare space, because previously you know your sock drawer was bigger. So it's just, I'm rambling on. Oh God, I hope my Mexican listeners are still listening. So yeah, they're my 5 ways I got my shit together. That's enough from me. You'll be delighted on my next episode. I'm going to be introducing one of my good friends, Matt, who a few of you might know. So here's a little snippet on the 4th episode featuring Matt.
Yeah, so I found myself 40-odd years old, wearing a bowler hat, dressed up as Oliver Hardy, and with Wayne, I was on sound, who works with me, and it was Stan Laurel, and it was an amazing thing to think, wow, I'm doing something that I've always wanted to do. And it only took me actually giving myself the permission. There was nobody stopping me but myself. I thought I needed to be a certain way. My dad was quite a straight-laced businessman, so he'd passed away, and I thought, well, I need to do him proud and I need to be like him. But everybody's different.
Looking forward to hearing Matt's journey on next episode, which will be released next week. If you do want to feature as a guest on my podcast, then please send us a tweet at bipolar7, or send us an email, Pete at bipolar@number7.co.uk, and it'll be great to have a bit of a chat. Complete open to what you want to say or what you want to promote, anything to do with mental health or a passion, being creative, how mental health, you know, has improved through any kind of passions you have out there. So it's a bit of an open forum. So have a great week and enjoy the rest of the sunshine. Take care. Okay, I'm going to start off, Matt, with the first question, and that is, how are you?
I'm good. I am really, really good. I'm at a good place in my life, I think, and it's not always been the case. But yeah, I feel like I've got my life, work-life balance sorted. I can walk or cycle to work, and I'm my own boss. I have been for about 17 years, so I can pretty much manage my time, and Monday mornings are not something to be feared, because the only person who's telling me what to do is me, and we quite get on, me and myself.
Okay, thanks for that, Matt. Moving on to the next question, I want you to tell me about how your mental health has been affected throughout your journey.
Probably going to go back to when I was 13, which is when, I suppose, that's when I first found out what depression was. I just was getting really, really, well, I'd been at a school that I really, really liked. I went to a convent school, and I was a bit of a performer, and used to like to tell jokes, still do, and music and different things. And I was really encouraged at that school by the nuns, and it wasn't all nuns that taught us, but it was nuns and teachers. And unfortunately, the school had to close, and I found myself. They put on a big show to close the school, and I got to go up on stage and do impressions in front of all my family and friends at a local theatre, and it was great. And then I went from that to another school, which was 40 minutes in another town, bus journey away. And after a few years, I found this slight sadness had come over me, and I was becoming frightened, scared of going into certain classes where I had to stand up and read or stand up and do mental arithmetic, that kind of thing. And it was affecting my health. I didn't realise, but I was getting sad, and with that sadness my energy was going, and I had lots of blood tests. People thought I had meningitis, and luckily I had a great father, and he sat me down and was like, look, what's the matter? If, you know, you're not actually ill. There's not any problems with your health. Blood tests are fine. And I'd kind of said, you know, I was scared of school. I was frightened of certain things. I remember being very frightened of nuclear war and things like that, which kids of my age didn't seem to be bothered about. But I watched a lot of television, you know, Panorama and all these kind of things. And my dad had been through it himself in his 30s. And he said, well, this is, you know, it kind of runs in our family. I had this anxiety, and I was on tablets. He said, and then I found out I was going to be a father, and I flushed the tablets down the toilet, and I managed to get a new job, and it was onwards and upwards, and everything was fine, and I've never looked back, and I've been able to run from that depression ever since. I've never needed. And he was a very wise man. So, yeah, I didn't have any medication or anything, but I learned to kind of cope with the anxiety at school. But I hadn't really returned to the flamboyant, kind of eccentric, funny kid that I was in my old school until I was in my teenage years, and I realised school was coming to an end, and I could choose what I wanted to be, what I wanted to do, and I wanted to work in television. So when I left school, I think my university years were great. I got to do the thing I wanted to do. It was less academic, it was hands-on. I was doing filmmaking and messing about. I always call it messing about. I still do, which sometimes I feel guilty for. You know, there's this guilt that, you know, work has to be hard and you have to have, you know, cuts and bruises and your back be aching and you have to suffer for things. But it's not necessarily true, which I found out later on. So all things were going great until I got to 26. And then unfortunately my dad, who was very close friend and mentor, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And I was 26. And he didn't last longer than a month or so. He was taken away from us quite quickly. And I'd taken time off work to be with him, and I actually was there holding his hand when he passed away. And, you know, you don't, it was like it wasn't a film. You know, you see these people take a final breath and shudder, and that's kind of it, this stillness. And so then you're into funerals and all the family and all that kind of thing. And then got back to work and decided I didn't like my job. I looked around and the people that were there, I really weren't close to. The job wasn't creative enough for me. There wasn't that much fun. And there had been, but it had gone. People had left, moved on. And so I set up my own business and basically set off like a rocket, really. But then that rocket ran out of steam and I started to have, although the business was going really, really well, started to have periods of anxiety. And it was strange, you know, because I was doing what I thought I wanted to do, but I was still unhappy. And I'd been through various long-term relationships, and I met a girl called Sophie, who's now my wife, and I realised things were going really, really well. And this depression, this low mood, everything came back. And I'd been handling it over the years by buying loads of books and trying to think of my way out of it, which had worked to a certain degree. But not having that father figure there, not having that mentor there, I realised I needed somebody to speak to. And so I went into therapy. And, you know, I'd known no therapy from films. You know, you see in America, everybody's talking about, look, I hear that drill outside. I've kept the window open to get this mood. So I'm not just in the studio. Anyway, therapy, you know, like analyse this. And everybody in America has a therapist and they always go on about it. And it seems to be an open thing. But in the UK, you know, I think if you mention the word therapist, you've got a therapist in most people. They think you're a nutcase. But I decided I was coming at the end of my tether because I knew I was really, really happy, but I was falling into this same cycle of being very, very depressed. And so I went into therapy, found a great therapist called Diane. And, just started talking through. It's basically, it's somebody to talk to. Somebody to talk to that's not a family member, that's not your partner, so you're not putting all your burdens on them. And you feel free, you can just talk. You know, you can talk without being judged and without it going anywhere. No one's going to hear it. And we started working through things. And it all came back, you know, to my childhood. I think there was one key therapy lesson where, you know, you kind of go into these things. You don't really have anything to say. And it's not, you don't have to do homework or anything like that. It's kind of, you just go in and you say what's on your mind at the time. And I've been walking through the park a few days before of an evening, a winter's evening, and it was foggy and you couldn't, it was a real pea super. You couldn't see anything. There was hardly any light. Just the street lights were lighting the path, but to the left of your right of you, just trees and then complete like fog. And I had my headphones on and I think it was a tune that I like that was playing. And I didn't realise I was skipping along the road, skipping along the pavement. And I caught myself when I saw myself skipping and I stopped and I became really emotional. I burst into tears, basically. And I burst into tears telling this back to my therapist. And to cut a long story short, what we realised was there was still this child in me. There was still this person from the convent school from when I was a kid, who wants to entertain, who wants to emulate his heroes, comedians, singers, all that kind of thing. And I'd got myself into a situation where I was trying to be really, really serious and start my own business, but it was in corporate video, and the work that I was doing was very, very serious and quite dry. And there was no outlet for this side of me, for this jokey, quite, you know, I used to do impersonations, I used to work in a radio station, I used to write comedy scripts, I was always larking about, and this, a lot of this had gone. And so I gave myself the permission, and I started another business with the guy that I work with, to just make films about things that we want to make films for, not being commissioned by anybody, but things that we, passion projects, things that we just wanted to do. And so we could use all the skills that we'd gained over the years and the equipment that we'd got from doing this corporate video, which was very well paid, but not necessarily as entertaining or creatively stimulating as I wanted it to be. And I bought a Morris Minor car, so we thought, okay, we'll do a documentary about Morris Minor. And that did really, really well. And it's just gone on, not just the documentaries have gone on really well. We've met loads of people, celebrities and different things, and one thing does lead to another. As a kid I used to love Laurel and Hardy, and when I was 15 I asked for a bowler hat for my 15th birthday, which not many 15-year-olds would ask for, let's be honest. And you know, a lot of people at the time were scratching their head like, what the hell does he want that for? But I'd kept this bowler hat, and I'd always kept the love of Laurel and Hardy from the age of 3 or 4, and so I ended up down at the Stan and Ollie premiere, through one thing or another, just getting in touch with people and asking. You know, a lot of this stuff, I've learned that if you're genuine and you just ask, you can get round lots of gatekeepers and lots of things that you wouldn't think. I found myself 40-odd years old, wearing a bowler hat, dressed up as Oliver Hardy, and with Wayne, I was on sound, who works with me, and it, as Stan Laurel, and it was an amazing thing to think, wow, I'm doing something that I've always wanted to do. And it only took me actually giving myself the permission. There was nobody stopping me but myself. I thought I needed to be a certain way. My dad was quite a straight-laced businessman, so he'd passed away, and I thought, well, I need to do him proud, and I need to be like him. But everybody's different. You're not the same as your father. You're not the same as any of your relatives, really. You're a mix of different DNA in a different time. You're born into a different time, and you have different friends and different family and everything, and they all have a different influence on you, music and everything. So you're unique, and you have to go with that. And if you don't, if you push that down, if you push the joys and try and be something else, and you push all that down, it's only going to make you ill. It's only going to... You're going to try and extinguish that flame, that spark of joy and creativity. If you try and push that down, it'll explode into emotions and sadness. And there was another point. I found a beautiful woman who, Sophie, who was on the right wavelength, and she'd also lost her father, and we decided to go away and get married in a small way, away from prying eyes, because we just something we always wanted. And I'd bought this hat, this smart hat for the wedding. And right at the last minute, I said to Sophie, I'd love to wear a bowler hat for my wedding. And she said, well, why don't you? It's your wedding. And again, it was that thing of like, what, you know, trying to be smart, trying to be what. But I, you know, bowler hat, ukulele. I started playing the ukulele with my cousin. So me and my cousin were more like brothers, grew up like brothers, and we'd always messed around with tape recorders at my grand's house when we were kids, and we'd sung together, and we decided to get back together and busk together some of the songs that we loved as kids. Did it for cancer research, and a Madness song. We must have put a lot of effort into it because we like Madness. So we sent this clip off, and a fan club got in touch with us, and we ended up doing a whole Madness set at the Dublin Castle, where Madness were discovered, and we made a load of new friends, and we even wrote some songs that for charity. And again, all that came from just allowing that little child inside, going back to the things that I'd always enjoyed, and thought that, you know, you have to grow up. And I think this feeling of having to grow up and having to conform that I'd probably forced upon myself, no one was making me, it made me unhappy. And so, yeah, so I think I had about 4 odd years of therapy. If I hadn't gone into therapy, I don't think I'd have got married. I think I'd have ran away from Sophie because this fear was coming over me. So it's brought me my marriage. It's brought me many creative projects. It's brought me relaxation in my life. And so I could, you know, I've never been on medication. I've tried to avoid that, but I'm not against it. I know that I have some people in my family that need medication in order to deal with the problem when the chemicals get so bad you can't go back. But with me, the therapy was the key, and something that if you haven't got somebody to talk to, or you don't want to talk about certain things to friends and family because you think they might judge you in another way, you might lose them in some way, which is probably not the case, but if that's how you feel, then definitely see a therapist. Go and speak to somebody that you can talk to and talk things out. And it's amazing. It's amazing what it comes down to, you know. My thing is to be yourself, you know. There's other things that I worked through, obviously the death of my father and bereavement and things that I'd not faced up to. But really it was down to I wasn't being myself. But it'll be different for different people. But definitely recommend.
Some interesting points there, Matt. Okay, next question. I want you to tell the audience about all the fun stuff you do that keeps you occupied and a bit more about your work.
So I've covered a lot of the things that I do. My main living is through corporate video, which involves working with businesses. But now I've always had a love of television and pop culture, and watched far too much television as a kid. I always wanted to make something that would be on TV. And so at the moment we're making documentaries on the other side of the business, which is called Spoon Jar Films, named after Tommy Cooper's routine. Spoon jar, jar, spoon, spoon jar, jar. Because my dad's favourite comedian was Tommy Cooper, so it's a little bit of a nod to that. And it's a bit of a Mickey take for those Ponzi companies that are called like Electric Banana and all this kind of thing. Spoon Jar Films, we're now trying to make. We've made a long form documentary called No Fair about a local girl that's lost her leg in a terrible incident in New York. And that was just a chance meeting. But, you know, there's a saying that when the pupil is ready, the teacher will appear. And I think that's what happened with us. We got to a stage, we'd made these short documentaries and we wanted to make a long form documentary. And literally Sian walked through the door and had her story. And we wanted to pursue that and see if we could help through film, through using our skills. That's all we have really. And so it's not out yet, but we have had some success with that. I'm also doing a documentary called In a Landfill Far, Far Away about buried Star Wars figures that were buried in the 1980s and they were somewhere around Leicester. And in that I've made some great friends at local toy shop, Joe and Gav, and we're making short YouTube videos and making little TV episodes on YouTube with a view, you know. Hopefully we might be able to get that somewhere. And so and I love playing the ukulele and singing with my cousin and writing songs in the vein of Madness, uplifting songs that we can release for charity and make it. I like making the pop videos that go with them as well. It's we get to do all the stuff that me and Nick used to watch and muck about as a kid. We actually get to act it out as adults. And he's a deputy head teacher, but he's still young at heart as well. So it's great that we can do that. I'm very happy that I picked up the ukulele again and went and started busking with him.
Some good stuff there, Matt. You've obviously found the things that you love in life, and you're making the most of your time spending doing those things, so that's good. Okay, moving on to the final question, and that's if you can offer one piece of advice to the audience who are listening
that you'd like to share on if they're going through a tough time? That one piece of advice that you'd really recommend.
So one piece of advice I'd offer. Well, I think it's going to sound really corny, but I don't mean it in a corny way, is for some people you do have to follow your dreams, and it's a tough, hard world out there, and you know, you lose people along the way. I mean, I lost my dad, but I also lost my gran, and they were very, very close to them both. And my gran used to say things like, "I'm my own boss, me," and "you can't take it with you," you know, and you know, things like that stick with me every day. So I'd say, you know, it's all about follow your dreams and listen to your heart, because you know, I don't want to be a person who is on my deathbed thinking, "What if?" You know, I'd like to have a lot of good stories to say and to tell people, and not be boring. And yeah, and also, you know, just give yourself a chance. Whenever you're feeling at your lowest, getting a bit emotional now, but you know, just give yourself a chance. Just talk to yourself. You're your own best friend. Sometimes you're the only person you have. I've been really, really down, and people haven't been able to understand at all what the problem is. And I've realised, well, I've got to do this myself. My dad's not there anymore, and I'm a great, you know, I'm 44, going on 45. And so just give yourself a break, be kind to yourself. And sometimes that's all you need. You know, we all race around and, you know, try and be perfectionist and all that kind of thing. But sometimes just getting started on something, just taking that first step, and it's amazing where a first step can take you. I mean, us picking up a ukulele to having a photograph on the wall at Dublin Castle next to Amy Winehouse, Madness and Travis, because the the woman that still runs the place, the Peggy Conlon, heard that we wrote the Dublin Castle song and wanted it on the wall. You know, we've not sold millions of records, we've not had a pop career, but we're up there by default, basically. And you know, I've got to meet a lot of my heroes. I've got to meet Vic Reeves, who was a hero of mine, through one thing leading to another, basically. And you know, you can trace things back, and who knows who knows where this will lead Pete with his podcast. You know, if you decide to suddenly get fit, who knows where just starting to walk, just going and walking around the block might lead to running a marathon. You don't know. But often we try to be perfectionists, and we try to, you look at the internet and you look at the world and you look at all these people doing fantastic things and think, "Oh, what's the point? You know, these guys are already good." But have your take on it, you know, do your thing. And whether that's being the world's smallest Madness tribute band, or whether it's making a documentary, whether it's painting a picture, writing a book, starting to cook, whatever that may be, just, you know, start it. It doesn't matter if you start and stop and it's not the right thing for you. But it's the same as, you know, when you think, "I can't go to a party, I don't want to go, it's too many people there that I don't know, I'm going to feel self-conscious." And yeah, everybody feels like that, to a lesser or to a more degree. And if you're feeling very low and you've got that kind of keeping up with the Joneses, you don't think that your life is as good as the other people that might be at the party, and they're going to be talking about mortgages and kids and fantastic holidays, and you haven't got that to talk about, go anyway, because you'll probably meet somebody, you'll probably get chatting to somebody who could become a friend for life, who all know, or who might know somebody else that go, "Oh, you remind me of a mate of mine. I'm like, you two should talk." You know, even if you just go to that party for an hour and go home. So yeah, I think there's enough advice there. I don't know how long I've gone on. I don't mind if Pete edits anything out. It's been a great opportunity to talk. Something I've never been on a podcast before. and I think it's great. It's wonderful that Pete's asked me. We've known each other for a long, long time, and we've shared our. We've been open with each other, and I know Pete's had his journey, and I've had mine. And it is hard to talk about it, and it's hard letting this go out into the world. Just like it's hard standing on the street corner singing Madness songs on a ukulele when people are walking by, and some people literally, here you go, turn the fan, you know, you can tell they're not into it. But then, you know, you'll get a boy going by on his bicycle who gives you the thumbs up, and then you're like, oh, wow, somebody else likes it. Okay, let's carry on. So, yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Pete. It's great that you're doing this, putting your heart around your heart and your sleeve, and good luck with the podcast.